And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Good to see you today, Bonnie.
Oh, thank you.
As every day. Well, today we begin with cultural thinker, sociologist, writer, and founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. He's Roman Kruznarek, and he's written a book which links modern-day thinking and living to the past, as far back as the Greeks and Romans. His book is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. And he joins us from London. Good evening, sir.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
There we go.
Well, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
You know, in theory, I have an echo.
Yeah, is there something we can do about that? Or?
Okay, let me try and just change my handset.
Okay, is that sounding better for you all?
Way better.
That's better.
Okay.
No more echo. Okay, so I was going to say, in theory, looking, you know, to past civilizations for great ideas on how we should live seems like a great idea. But do you think it's practical or will be heeded in today's mega-paced, fast-paced, digital techno world?
Well, it's interesting, actually, that when you look through history, you sometimes start seeing that civilizations in the past actually had smarter solutions to our life dilemmas than we do today. I mean, take the idea of love, for example. You know, we have this one word, love, now that we use for so many different ideals and relationships. We whisper, I love you, over a romantic meal, then sign an email, lots of love. But the ancient Greeks, you know, 2,500 years ago, were actually more sophisticated than us. They had 6 different words for love. There was one word, eros, which was about sexual passion. Another word for love was called philia, which was for deep friendships, where you really sacrifice for someone. You know, the opposite of a Facebook friendship. There was a word for selfless love and a healthy kind of self-love. And the Greeks thought we should tap into all these different kinds of love to have a full love life. And actually, I think that's a rather interesting and pretty smart way of thinking about bringing a bit more love into your everyday life.
But don't we have those 6 different forms of love just without those names? We don't have names for all of them. We call them one thing.
Well, I think what happens is that we know about all those kinds of love. They make sense to us. So when I've given talks about love, even to, say, you know, 14-year-olds, you know, who don't have a great vocabulary about love, they get all those kinds of love. But what happens is that we are obsessed with the idea of romantic love. 94% of young Americans say they are looking for a soulmate, one person to embody all of these loving needs, one person to be their sexual partner and to grow old with and to have children with and everything. And so I think when you start breaking down love into these different kinds and really see them all together, then you start realizing, well, maybe I'm asking too much of a single relationship and I ought to start spreading the love, as it were.
You give so much respect for the Greeks and Romans, and though their civilizations lasted a long time, they both did crumble.
They did crumble, and they certainly weren't perfect. I mean, if you take another topic like the history of conversation, for example, the Greeks were hopeless at it. You know, family conversations didn't thrive in ancient Greece. People weren't open with their emotions like they are today in the age of Freud and Oprah. I think we can't learn everything from the Greeks. You know, men didn't speak to women. They shunted women away in their households. So I don't think we should be nostalgic about the past. We should just try and look for the best ideas and run with them.
Well, when it comes to conversation, I think it's interesting that you put Freud and Oprah in the same breath, but because they're so different. But when it comes to conversation, what can we learn from the past then? Because you've just pointed out that it wasn't so good back in those days.
Yeah, I think we have to, when you look at something like conversation, is to look at the historical progression and see how actually we've been getting better at the art of conversation. I mean, back in the 18th century, conversation was all about showing off about your fine knowledge of poetry and theater and clever quips to your friends. In the 19th century, it started getting a bit better, where people started becoming more emotionally open, particularly men. But again, I think what you see historically in the last half century is that in some ways things have been closing down, particularly the rise of online culture, which has been threatening conversation. We're spending more time in superficial contact with people, sending 1 billion texts a year. We have to watch out for the loss of face-to-face conversation, which we've struggled so long to gain. So I think we need to be very wary of it, actually.
How about Asian cultures and their long-time reverence for older people, especially their family members? Is that changing as they get more modern and participate in more American-style lives?
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the history of family life, where Asia particularly has been a place where we've looked for different kinds of family relationship. You know, the great sort of respect that parents often have for their children have for their elders, which in some ways is the opposite of what we so often do today in the Western world, which is put older people away into sort of ghettos, which we know as nursing homes or care homes. But that's actually changing in China and Japan now, where more and more young people are no longer, for example, living with their parents as they used to. But I think we can still, when we're thinking about aging, when we're thinking about the realities of death, again, we can still learn from history. Go back to medieval times when life was actually shorter. People lived half as many years as they do today. People actually had a greater passion for life. They weren't spending 4 hours a day watching television. They actually lived with more vibrancy because they felt the presence of death a little bit more around them. And I think we need to get a little bit more of that into our lives now.
Staying with the family for a moment, it appears that that house husband isn't such a new phenomenon after all.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, when I started writing this book, I was about to, my partner was about to have twins, actually. We were going to have twins. And I kind of assumed that looking after children was mostly something that women did a bit more than men. But actually, when you look through history, I realized I was completely wrong. That in the pre-industrial period in Europe and North America, men were much more hands-on fathers than they actually are today, partly because they worked more around the home doing craft work or in local agriculture, partly because women died so often in childbirth. You know, today, 1 in 12 single-parent households are headed by men. Between 1600 and 1800, it was 1 in 4. So the idea of the modern super dad who can change diapers blindfolded is not a modern invention, and I've been inspired by those fathers of the past to get a bit more involved myself.
Do you change the diapers?
Oh, yeah, not blindfolded. It's pretty hard with twins.
Yeah, I guess so.
In your book, you remarked that most people today spend more time in their car than at the meal table with their families and loved ones.
That's right. You know, the average meal today, fast food meal, is, you know, over in about 10 minutes. We spend more time in our cars than actually sitting down at the family meal. And I think in many ways, we are sort of, there's a famine of conversation in our relationships with partners, in family life, with husbands and wives. And we need to try and do something about that. And I think one of the keys to it is rediscovering empathy, really, rediscovering empathic listening, ratcheting up the quality of conversation in our relationships, in the household. And that's something that we can all work on simply by listening harder to other people's needs, listening harder to other people's feelings.
But where's the time to do that? I mean, if both parents work, the children come home from school, they're not there, they do their homework. Yeah, I mean, there just isn't really the family unit the way there was because of the times demand different things.
I mean, you're absolutely right to highlight that problem of time. I mean, 25% of Americans feel constantly rushed. That figure goes up to 40% for single mothers. But here again, I think history is really interesting. I mean, look back at Leonardo da Vinci wasn't constantly looking at his watch or checking his electronic calendar when he was painting The Last Supper. You know, our obsession with time and stressful lives is partly a historical invention. You know, throughout the centuries, we've increasingly sliced time up into tiny portions. You know, it wasn't until, you know, 1700 the clocks started having minute hands on them. Before that, they only had hour hands. It wasn't until 1800 that they started having second hands. And then we start having clocking in for factory workers. So I think we need to try and rediscover slow time living when we can. And it is hard when you're pressured with the kids baying for their dinner as mine are about to. We need to start, you know, thinking about doing less rather than more, you know, about doing slow time activities, going to an art gallery and visiting one painting or just a room full rather than looking at everything. You know, even putting yourself on a chronological diet. I recommend people try putting away their watch for a weekend and seeing whether they find it liberating. Sometimes it can be a disaster, but actually it is normally giving them new kinds of freedom.
We're speaking with Roman Krusnarek. He's a cultural thinker and writer on the art of living, a founding faculty member of the School of Life. And his latest book is How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and get your feedback as well if you'd like to join in. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Roman Krusnarek. And we're talking about his book, How Should We Live? Roman, what's your view of the popular self-help movement?
It's really interesting, actually, that for most of history, philosophers and thinkers have actually been writing self-help books under a different name. Go back to ancient Greece, Plato and Aristotle, the great medieval thinkers like Montaigne. Today, self-help we think of as mostly sort of pop psychology, bullet point books. But actually, I think that self-help is a much wider tradition. The problem is that most self-help books have drawn on ideas mostly from psychology or spiritual thought, and they've tended to ignore history. And that seems crazy to me because we've all been dealing for the last 3,000 years or longer with the big dilemmas in life, how to make love last, how to reach our potential, how to find fulfilling work and face death. So I think we need to reinvent the self-help book by taking it deep into the past.
It reminds me of George Carlin. He had a line that went something like, I went to a bookstore and asked the saleswoman, where's the self-help section? She said if she told me, it would defeat the purpose.
Right. And I think, you know, we can look for the clues for living everywhere in inspiring people as well as in, you know, modern psychology.
When you mentioned work, I thought of your last book, How to Find Fulfilling Work. You advise to experiment and act first. What does history teach us about that?
Well, think of somebody like the painter Vincent van Gogh, for example. He wasn't somebody who, you know, found his vocation by having a moment of epiphany as a child or something like that. He was experimental in life in finding fulfilling work in his vocation. He started out as an art dealer. He was an elementary school teacher in a rather miserable seaside town in England. He was an evangelical preacher in the Belgian coal mines. Tried lots of different things until he stumbled upon painting and drawing. And I think there's this golden thread looking through history that people who have lived deep and sucked all the marrow from life, as Thoreau would have put it, have been experimental in their life and work. And I think that's one of the secrets to the art of living, really, to take those risks and be courageous when we can.
You know, you talk about the virtues of the Renaissance man or woman, you know, where you could do many things, but who has time to explore other interests when you're busy making ends meet?
Yeah, sometimes it is absolutely impossible. If you're holding down two jobs, trying to pay the poor mortgage and buy, you know, shoes for your children, then, you know, we don't have time to expand ourselves and our creative selves and really, you know, flower as individuals. But I think that we can try and do what we can. You know, in the workplace, one of the classic, you know, strategies, I think, for finding more fulfillment is trying to set yourself tasks which are known as flow tasks, where you set yourself challenging and creative tasks which, in a way, you know, push you a bit and push your skills, but are not so boring, you know, that they sort of turn you off. So I think we can try and find spaces in everyday life, and even if we're struggling financially, we can still rethink the way we approach things like love. It doesn't cost anything to try out experimenting with the different varieties of love that the ancient Greeks teach us. So I think we can, you know, pick and choose what we want in ways that can suit our different lives, depending where we are.
If you'd like to join in the conversation today with Roman Krusnarek, the name of his book, How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life, please join us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576.
Tell us the story of C.P. Ellis, if you would.
Yeah, C.P. Ellis, Claiborne Paul Ellis, is one of the most fascinating people in modern history. He was born in North Carolina, in Durham, 1927. He was from a poor, white, working-class background. And he was actually a white supremacist. He was a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Astonishingly, he also was one of the great figures in the history of U.S. race relations and the history of empathy, I discovered. In 1971, his life radically changed when he was asked to go to a community meeting to tackle racial problems in local schools. And to his astonishment, he was elected to be the co-chair of this community group meeting with an African-American civil rights activist called Ann Atwater, who he hated with a purple passion. And what actually happened was that working with Ann Atwater blew away his prejudices and assumptions about African-Americans. Remember, this was a Ku Klux Klan leader. He realized that Ann Atwater, like him, was, you know, struggling to make ends meet. He, at the time, was working as a janitor at Duke University. She was a domestic cleaner. He realized that she was just another person with family struggles like him. At the end of this 10-day community meeting, he stood up in front of 1,000 people and tore up his Ku Klux Klan membership card. I think it was one of these great turning points in the history of race relations, and C.P. Ellis later became a leader of a janitor's union that was 70% African-American, and he and Ann Atwater became friends for the rest of their lives. But what it showed was the power of empathy, I think, to transform individual lives and social change. And my, you know, I really have this deep belief in the importance of empathy. So I've recently actually just launched a new website project called the Empathy Library at empathylibrary.com, where you can find books and films all about how to expand your empathic potential.
TheEmpathyLibrary.com?
Yeah, just called empathylibrary.com.
Empathy Library. You also talk about George Orwell.
Yeah, Orwell was another of these great empathic adventurers. Many people who know his work will know him as a novelist who wrote 1984 or the dystopian book, Animal Farm. Mm-hmm. But actually, many people don't know that in the 1920s, Orwell, who was from a very privileged background, very wealthy background, actually dressed up as a tramp and spent months, even years, as a hobo on the streets of East London, trying to discover how the other half lived. And it was an extraordinary experiment of trying to step into the shoes of people living on the social margins. He wasn't the first person to do that. I mean, St. Francis of Assisi did it in the 13th century. But I think Orwell teaches us, really, that when we step into other worlds and have conversations with people who are different from us, conversations with strangers, it can really transform us and surprise us.
Tell us more about the School of Life in London that you co-founded. What's that about?
Yeah, the School of Life is a place where you can learn everything you need to know that about everyday living that you can't learn in a school or college or regular university. We offer classes and courses on how to make relationships last, you know, how to find fulfilling work, how to face the inevitabilities of death. And it's interesting that since we opened our doors in 2008, we now have about 100,000 people doing our classes each year. We are now expanding to Brazil, opening the United States this year. It actually shows, I think, a hunger around the world for people who are trying to rethink their lives. I think we face a crisis in the art of living. In the United States, job satisfaction is at record low levels. 1 in 4 people are going to face a mental health problem at some point in their life. 50% of people get divorced. I don't think we're living in a very happy world. So in a way, it's no wonder that many people are struggling for answers to how to rethink everyday life.
Do you ever feel unfulfilled, unhappy?
Absolutely, all the time. I think that if you write books on the art of living, it's a mistake. Probably if you think you've got all the answers and you've got a perpetual smile on your face. You know, I'm about to actually go downstairs and make a dinner for my children, and I know there are going to be battles there, and I'm going to be thinking how I can be a better parent, how I can be a better partner, how I can find more fulfillment in my work. So I actually think that having something of that struggle in our lives, trying to close the gap between what we believe and how we actually behave is what, you know, the art of living is really all about.
And what are you having for dinner tonight in London?
I'm going to have to improvise when I open the fridge. There could be anything in there, I don't know. but actually, I think spontaneity is something that we all need a little bit more of as well. It can all help add a little bit of a spice to our lives.
So you do talk about how we should live, but you also talk about how we should die, or how we should address dying. Explain what you mean by death style.
Yeah, I think if you open a newspaper or magazine, you'll always see lifestyle sections. But what about death style sections? I'd like to see them too. By death style, I mean the art of growing old, facing our mortality, and dying well. And I think death is something that we tend not to talk about much in modern society. It's a taboo subject like sex was in the 19th century. But look around us, and some cultures have retained a very healthy way, I think, of thinking about death. Look at the idea of the jazz funeral in New Orleans, or the rituals and festivals around the Day of the Dead in Mexico, where people are willing to think about mortality, and I think it gives us a greater love of life, actually. And I think a little bit more of what we can take from those cultures and bring into our own lives, I think can, again, add a kind of vibrancy to us. Because if we don't recognize, you know, the shortness of life and the reality of death, we're going to end up sleepwalking through life.
Of course, before there were funeral homes, people would be laid out in the parlor, so the name was changed to the living room.
That's fascinating, that, isn't it? You know, young children used to see death. I mean, my children have never, you know, seen a dead body, and they probably never will. But 100 years ago, you know, people saw death everywhere, and it wasn't a morbid thing. It was something that people saw as part of everyday life. But now we tend to hide death or illness and things like that. And I think, again, I think we need to try and face a little bit more of it and not hide from the realities of it.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to close with this. You say that a key to living well is to close the gap between our beliefs and our actions. And what can we learn from history there?
I think there you need to look to an inspirational figure, and the one I love turning to is the novelist Leo Tolstoy, who people remember maybe for War and Peace and the novel Anna Karenina. But he was someone who was always trying to put his beliefs into practice. He, you know, and was changing his beliefs all the time. He went to war in the Crimean War in the 1850s, but that experience of being a soldier turned him into a pacifist. He was someone who was born into the aristocracy, but then he recognized that he should work the land with the peasants. He actually owned serfs, and that he should try and discover how the other half lived, a little bit like George Orwell. But he never found it easy. You know, he never gave up his great estate, even though he gave up much of his literary wealth. He believed in universal love, but he was always fighting with his wife. But look at his life, and you'll see that he was always struggling to try and be true to his beliefs. And I think ultimately, that's all that each of us can try and do.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Roman Krusnarek, cultural thinker and writer on the art of living, founding faculty member of the School of Life, advises organizations from Oxfam to the UN on using empathy in conversation to create social change. And the website, another new website, he said, is empathylibrary.com. His latest book, How We Should Live, How Should We Live? Great Ideas from the Past for Everyday Life. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Food and Dining is next. And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. I guess we learned a lot from that first segment of how to look at life. Well, it's a clear, cool, sunny, beautiful South Florida Thursday, and Food and Dining is now on our platter. Joining us is chef, author, and syndicated columnist, my old friend, our old friend, Linda Gastnauber. I don't mean old.
Longstanding, thank
long-standing.
You.
Longstanding, okay.
All right.
So what's on the menu today, Linda? Okay.
So, Joe and Bonnie, hi, nice to be with you.
Hello.
Okay, so was one of your New Year's resolutions to take off a few pounds or maybe some of those extra pounds from the holidays? Well, no, they're both smiling at me. We're 3/4 of the way into January. So how are you doing? Well, our guest today is going to help us out. He's Scott Harris, and he's created a company to help us stay on the straight and narrow. And it's called Deliver Lean, and it's a food delivery company. So let's welcome Scott Harris.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, we're happy because you've brought us food.
Indeed.
Filled up the studio. One more time. Here we go.
All juices. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for our guest? Have you tried a food delivery system? Let us know. Are there some food delivery systems out there that you know about? You'd like to tell us about them. Give us a call. That's 800 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email today, Bonnie?
radio@WLRN.org.
Okay, and the phones are open now. Also with us, of course, is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we drinking today, or should I ask?
Hi, guys. It's a beautiful snowy day here. I'm looking out on my bird feeder outside with an 8-inch snow cap on it. So I got your beautiful
your bird
day
feeder?
Here, too. Yeah.
Are there birds there at this time of year in Michigan?
Well, the ones that are here are really in need of some seed. So we try to keep up with them.
Fred's in
anyway,
Michigan, by the way.
If you're going to have meals delivered to your house, you probably want to have some wine delivered to your house. So I'm going to talk about that.
Okay, great. Sounds good to me. Well, let's go to Scott Harris. So what is Deliver Lean, Scott?
So Deliver Lean makes calorically balanced meals, and we deliver them to your home and business. We deliver 3 times a week, and we actually deliver in the middle of the night, which adds convenience.
So in the middle of the night, you're going to be coming knocking at my door?
So we don't knock on the door, okay. But we actually leave a bag, an insulated cooler bag, and we leave your meals. So when you wake up for added convenience, the meals are at your home.
And ready to go.
And what about the raccoons or something?
Oh, that's a good question. We haven't come across that
no
yet.
Raccoons. Well, no, it's raccoons in an insulated bag. It's kind of hard to smell through the bags, I would think.
And it is sealed. So the bags are individually sealed and tamper-proof.
So how does it work? Do we call you up? I mean, how do we do this? Is there a fee?
So the meals come, they're calorically balanced between 300 and 400 calories apiece. The meals are as little as $7.95. And you can choose how many meals you want and actually mix and match meal plans. So should you be somebody who wants 400 calorie meals, which would be our traditional meal plan, that comes with a lean protein source, chicken, fish, beef, pork, turkey, a gluten-free complex carb and a vegetable. Should you want to eliminate the complex carb and have a protein source and a vegetable, we can do that too. If you're a vegetarian, we can accommodate. If you're a vegan, we can accommodate. And we can also mix and match the meal plans. So the key to retention or actually sticking to a diet or a meal plan is variety.
So, for example, like there's two people in the family. One's on a paleo diet and one's on it wants to eat real food or whatever. You could order different meals for different people?
Absolutely. You can order different meals for different people, or you can actually mix and match. So should you be someone who travels a lot and want to wrap on your meal plan, no problem. If you feel you lack roughage and you want salads in your meal plans, we can mix and match different meal plans depending on what
you have some nutritionist working with you.
That's a great question. So every meal is, while I say calorically balanced, it actually goes to a dietitian. So while we do menu correlation and container appeal, people typically eat with their eyes. And when they think about a meal plan, they usually feel like it's going to be some sort of punishment. So we go ahead and make sure that the meals not only look great, but taste great, and they are also dietitian approved. So the ingredients is labeled on the outside of every container.
I don't suppose you have a sausage-heavy diet for people like Joe.
Or chicken fried steak.
Well, talking about sausage and all, Joe's got some food in front of him.
Yes, I do.
So Joe, tell us what you've got in that. There's a hamburger there, isn't there something?
Scott, there's a turkey burger here, yeah.
It's surprisingly good.
Okay, so he's opening up the package, and Fred, it's a turkey burger, you know, it's not a beef burger.
And it has spinach on top of it.
Oh, I bet you love that, Joe.
Scott, in case you don't know, Joe's our beef eater here.
Right.
It's pretty good.
More like pork.
Pork eater?
Yes.
Okay. So, Joe, if he says it's pretty good, yeah. It is. Let me tell you.
Mm-hmm. And so, it has tomatoes on it, too.
Okay.
If he's going back for more, then...
He's taking a second bite. That's interesting. So, Joe...
That's a very good sign.
Yes. How many calories does it say on
more
that
peppers.
Box?
How many calories?
And is there a bun there as well?
291 calories, 25 grams of protein, 12 grams of carbs.
Wait, that's
a big portion.
That's only 290-something calories?
Mm-hmm. 291.
And we didn't warm it. I mean, that should have been warmed in a microwave?
It could be. On the outside of every label, again, you have calories, proteins, carbohydrates. It tells you if you should heat it up or not. And, you know, most people feel like when they get on a meal plan that they're going to be lacking something or it's going to be a punishment. And we find that most people eat too infrequently and too large a portion. So if you graze all day long, you'll get incredible results. And a lot
so
of
wait. Not every
so
minute.
So you're saying not to eat that at a meal, but to actually extend it over...
Well, the meals are geared in such a way that they are between 300 and 400 calories. So we would like you to eat every 3 to 4 hours. So when I say graze throughout the day, it speeds up your metabolism and ultimately gets you results. And I want to also say that this is not a diet. It's more of a lifestyle, vanity being the byproduct of just eating healthy. So if you do eat smaller portions, more frequent feedings, you will get great results.
So if you had 5 portions at 400 calories... we'd get to our 2,000-calorie-a-day diet that the government thinks we should be eating. Or you could have less if that's what you want.
That's exactly right.
Do some people get the service just Monday through Friday, and then on the weekends, splurge?
That's a great question. Most people usually eat 4 meals a day, 6 days a week, take off Sunday as a splurge day. And even on that splurge day, after you are accustomed to eating smaller portions and more frequent feedings, when you do go out to a restaurant and they give you that large portion, you find like you take probably half of it home because you're accustomed to eating smaller portions. Mm-hmm. So people that have eaten our meals for an extended period have had, you know, feel better, look better, and adds more time back in your life. And that, as you know, to eat a specific way is very time consuming, expensive, and challenging to do consistently.
Well, let's talk about expense for a minute here. So there's no fee. And for every package that you have, it's $7.95. Is there a delivery fee?
There is a delivery fee. We deliver 3 days a week on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We guarantee the food to your home before 7 a.m. Most deliveries are done before 4 a.m., depending on when people wake up. So a meal is only $7.95 a piece. So should somebody eat 4 meals a day, it's roughly $30 a day.
How did you start this? What got you interested in this? That's
a great question. So I found myself going to the office every day, as most people that have jobs, and drinking coffee up until 2 o'clock and then sitting down and having a large portion and then having espresso all afternoon. So
sounds familiar.
Right, like the average working person, right? So, and I was tired of all my employees going out to lunch every day, and it wasn't the 30
Not
minutes.
Not tired because they went out to lunch, but tired because they came
tired. Well, both. Okay. I mean, when I'd look outside and see that my entire company was gone, and it was the 30 minutes to figure out where to go, the hour to go, and then an hour to get reacclimated once they returned, it took up roughly 35% of my workday was lunch and the distraction of lunch. And then when they came back, they were lethargic and drinking espresso all afternoon. So we had hired a chef who were making calorically balanced meals, and I saw a huge increase in productivity and morale and actually work ethic. People really enjoyed it, less absentee, less tardiness. So I said, wow, you know what, this is an interesting concept. Who else is in the cook fresh, deliver daily business, because it fits into the wellness umbrella? And have they done it effectively? So I ordered everybody's meals in the industry, and I felt like they were all lacking in one way or another, whether it be quality or variety, because the key to retention is variety, and people need to, you know, not get tired of the food.
Mm-hmm. What was the plan that Dan Marino used to hawk on TV all the time?
Well, we don't want to talk about that, but it's frozen, and it's shipped. So our food is cooked fresh, delivered daily. Mm-hmm. When I say daily, every other day. And nothing is frozen, so it's really,
healthy. If, for example, if you delivered the meals, and then I found I was going out to dinner or something, could I freeze them? Not the salads, obviously, but
I mean, you could, but no. I mean, you could freeze them, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't taste as good, and that's really not what we believe.
But you can refrigerate them.
Well, absolutely.
So
you could refrigerate
how long?
Them.
I mean, for example, if you deliver on 3 days a week. And you're giving me 2 days worth of food
That's
on
right.
those 3 days.
That's right.
So then, so it can last in the refrigerator for a little bit.
Oh, sure. The food has, you know, a 3, 4, 5 day shelf life.
Oh, it
However,
does.
Because
mm-hmm.
we deliver every 2 days, should you eat 4 meals a day on Monday, we would deliver 8 meals. And you can eat them in any order, depending on your palate. So breakfast clearly is breakfast. And then we do in-between meals as well.
Well, I've got some here in front of me. And I've got a wrap here, and it's a shrimp wrap with mango and cabbage slaw. And I have to
wow.
tell you that this one is quite good, actually. I went back for another piece.
I'm happy you enjoyed it.
And so that would have been my lunch, or I could have had it for a snack.
You could. You know, wraps are interesting. Some people like wraps because they find themselves on the go all day. And, you know, traveling, they're very convenient to eat in your car and don't need to be heated up. So wraps are a great in-between meal.
That was great. Yeah. Terrific. Well, we're eating away and enjoying ourselves, and it's time for a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking with Deliverlean CEO Scott Harris. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking about starting the new year with good foods that happen to be good for us, too. Our guest is Scott Harris. He's the CEO of Deliverlean. It's a delivery service. It's a no-fuss way to eat. He's been telling us all about it, and we've been enjoying it. And I saw Joseph Cooper go back for seconds on a turkey burger, which was really amazing. And by the way,
you could use a little mayo.
A great way to enjoy some interesting wines and a microbrew is this Saturday. Is the 25th, on the 25th rather, it's the Drink Around the World Festival, and it's a fundraiser for the Ronald McDonald House Charities of South Florida, 7:30 to 11 p.m. It's at the Moore Building in the Design District. If you want some more information about this, go to drinkaroundtheworldfestival.com. Well, before we drink with Fred Tasker, we're going to have dinner in minutes, and it's a little chilly out tonight, so we've got a warm soup that only takes you 20 minutes to make. It's Italian sausage minestrone, and yes, Joe, it is a turkey sausage.
Of course.
Of course. You could use any kind of sausage you want, but this one is so simple. It has vegetables and pecans, and they combine with basil. And as I said, it only takes 20 minutes to make this soup. So I sauteed the turkey sausage. I cut it up into pieces, some onions, some green beans, just for about 5 minutes. Then I added some chicken broth. And by the way, if you go into the supermarket and look at some of the chicken broth or chicken stock there, they've really, really lowered the salt content from about 540 milligrams to 140, which is great. So you add some chicken broth, some diced tomatoes, and simmer that for about 10 minutes. And while the soup is cooking, I boiled up some pasta. And I used a soup pasta, Cini Pepe, but it's a great way to use up different pieces of pasta you may have left over in your cupboard. So cut the pasta up into small pieces and boil it up, drain it, and add it to your soup. A little Parmesan cheese, and you've got a delicious one-pot meal for this cool evening in minutes. The complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, I'm going to talk about having wine delivered to your home, and for the most part, it's pretty simple. All you have to do is call your favorite wine shop and order wine to be delivered, and have a credit card handy, and have someone over 21. They have to be there to sign for it, of course, and they won't leave it. They can't leave it on your doorstep. You have to be there to deliver it. And the way you would choose the wines is you can Google the websites of the wine shops to see their selections and their prices and that kind of thing. And then you can order it by phone, or in a lot of cases, you can order it online. Now, most of the big wine shops in Dayton Broward will charge a delivery fee of $15 to $30. And that's whether it's a single bottle or a case. And it kind of depends on the distance they have to bring it. Another hint, though, is if they don't have the wine you want in stock, a lot of shops will try to find it for you. And sometimes that depends on whether that wine is carried by one of their distributors. But here, it helps to build an in-person relationship with your wine merchant. It's a good idea if you're into wine to get to know your wine merchant so you can call them up and say, hey, this is Fred and I need a favor. Also, Florida is one of the 40 or so states that permits private wine fans to order wine directly online from the wineries in California or other states.
So that was approved here in Florida then?
Yeah, there are about 40 states that have it and 10 that don't. There are certain restrictions on it, but if you go to order wine, they'll tell you what they are. And a good example is the Behringer Winery in Napa, one of their top wineries there. You can go online and order for example, its Cabernet Sauvignon for $40. And for a single bottle, the shipping is $20, so that's kind of high. But for a whole case, the shipping is only $34, just $14 more. So it might pay to get several bottles at a time. And a lot of the big wineries also have wine clubs. At Behringer, if you join the Taste of Behringer Club, they will automatically send you two or three bottles every 2 months for $70 to $100. But in doing this, you become a member, and you get a 20% discount on wine. And if you visit the winery at any point, they give you a free wine tasting. And this might be the best part. They even give you a toll-free number to ask wine questions of their wine experts. Now, my advice would be I wouldn't go online to order a bottle from a winery if I can buy it locally because of the delivery charges. But I would do it to buy specialty wines. Quite often, even a major winery will have a new wine, an experimental wine, and they've only made 500 cases, and they can't turn it over to a national distributor because it's not enough. So they sell that at the winery and online. Or something even better, maybe you can access boutique wineries that are too small to deliver and to distribute any of their wines nationwide. And if you do that, you can get some real gems that way.
Sounds good to us. Thank you, Fred. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Amy. Amy in Fort Lauderdale. Amy, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is in regards, well, actually, backstory. I was very successful on a food delivery program, Jenny Craig, many years ago, and I lost a lot of weight. And I think that it's really great providing people that service. But since then, I've become a vegan, and I would love to learn more about what sort of offerings they have for somebody with such a specialty diet, and also the way that the food is planned to be heated up. I'm not really a big fan of using my microwave a lot, and that was one of my problems that I had with the previous food delivery program that I had. So I'm just interested to know the different ways they, you know, if it's just microwave-based or not.
Excellent. So we do have a vegan meal plan, which is actually all organic. And it does come in a 24-ounce microwavable container. However, you don't have to microwave the food. You could actually put it on a plate and heat it up differently. So some of the meals, and it will tell you on the outside of the container, it does detail carbohydrates, protein, and calories. And it can tell you if we encourage you to heat it or not. So should you want to heat it in an oven, no problem. Just take it out of the container and heat it in an oven.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amy.
Oh, I was just curious about the protein base, like if you guys are using a lot of soy to kind of incorporate the protein in for a vegan diet, or if you're using more beans and things like that.
Beans and power grains.
He has a dietitian on board that plans all of these things, and the chef who makes it. And I wanted to just give you a suggestion that I've used. If you didn't want to use a microwave, if you put a large pan with water in it and then another pan on it and then put the plate on that, and it's kind of warming, and heat the water and the plate will warm and your food will warm in a moist way. And it is a way to warm some things if you don't want to use the microwave or the oven.
And the quinoa is really good.
Yeah, we have many, many different offerings daily. You know, again, the key to retention is variety. So I would urge you to go online and you can look at our vegan meal plan menu. And as well, we could email you a menu.
What's the website?
The website is deliverlean.com.
Okay, that's easy. Well, it's really been a very tasty week. Scott Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the food is delicious. We're all going back from seconds, and I notice everyone outside the studio here is coming to eat this food.
I'm very happy you enjoyed it.
His company is Deliver Lean. You can find more about it, as he just mentioned. It's at deliverlean.com, Deliver Lean, one word. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph,
I'm
glad
to get back to this turkey patty.
Well, isn't that interesting? And Bonnie, you have a vegetarian meal in front of you.
I see. The quinoa was really excellent, and I haven't tasted it. And the sweet potatoes.
And I have here, it's curry chicken with peppers, cabbage, and carrots.
Mm.
Whoa, okay.
Bonnie, maybe you can turn Joe into a vegan.
I think when pigs fly.
Next week, we'll be having a Super Bowl bash with tongue-in-cheek chef Jamie DeRosa. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information and links at the WLRN Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Bonnie and I return Monday with a panel discussion on the history, pros, and cons of charter schools. And here's our all-quality TV calendar for January 23rd. On this day in 1975, 39 years ago, the premiere of cop comedy Barney Miller at the 12th Precinct on ABC. Fish, Dietrich, Wojo, and deplorable coffee. Abe Vigoda is still living, aged 92. Star Hal Linden began his career as a big band musician and singer. And on this day in 1977, 36 years ago, the first episode of Alex Haley's miniseries, Roots, is aired to critical acclaim again on ABC. And one more while we continue to master our domain. On this day in 1991, 23 years ago, the debut of the first full season of Seinfeld on NBC. Yada, yada, yada. Today's recipe at dinnerandminutes.com. Our theme music, composed by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from Jerry Seinfeld, who is an amateur wrestler, called himself the Jewish Terror. Quote, men don't care what's on TV. They only care what else is on TV. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned next for Here and Now from Where Else But NPR News.